Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Coming up, Stuart Ainsworth and Lawrence Shaw investigate whether an ancient site could be hiding secrets that Time Team could uncover.
We need to navigate our way around and look at all aspects of this slope. I guess it is downhill from here now, then.
Carenza Lewis has an update from all the test pits we dug in the village of Norton Disney.
And you'll learn how the realistic Time Team graphics are made.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Today, we're here on YouTube as well as wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you can find us ad-free for our Time Team members on Patreon.
Now, people often ask me how a site for a Time Team programme is chosen. What needs to be considered before everyone arrives with their trowels ready to get stuck in? Well, numerous contenders are discussed at what we call a site wrestle, something our Time Team members may well be familiar with, because we gave you the opportunity to watch our most recent one last year, where archaeologists state the case for why we should visit somewhere. And after a bit more work behind the scenes, a preliminary recce is done to determine if further investigation with Time Team's resources could tell us more.
And that's what we want to show you now, actually. Not long ago, Stuart Ainsworth and Lawrence Shaw headed to Kielder to carry out further investigation of a site that Lawrence had been interested in because of its amazing preservation and a kind of curious location as well. It's a large group of medieval buildings, but we don't really know what they are. Could it be a village, maybe? It's right on the edge of where it's possible to live.
Stuart, welcome to Kielder Forest in Northumberland, or should I say welcome back? Because I think you've worked here quite a bit in the past.
I started off my archaeological career up here, believe it or not, just under 50 years ago, long before you were born.
Just over behind me here on that slight brow, the first brow nearest us, about 800 metres, is a site called Colour Clough, which is this supposed medieval shealing site. Mm-hmm. What's really exciting is to be able to bring you and your knowledge here to help us try and unpick what's going on there. We've had some additional surveys undertaken on the site, mm-hmm. some geophysics, some magnetometry and resistivity, some topographical surveys, but you can't beat a bit of a yomp.
Well, that's the nub of this. You've got to look at the stuff on the ground, look at the relationship between the structures that are there. You've got to look at the context mm-hmm. as well. It's not just a yomp down the site. We need to navigate our way around and look at all aspects of this slope as well as the site itself. So I guess it is downhill from here now, then.
We've got a couple of my colleagues with me. Let's go and join up with them and go and check out this exciting site.
Okay, then.
Richard, what a lovely part of the world that you work in up here.
Yes, welcome to Wild Kielder. It's not a bad place to call an office.
And we're sat on this beautiful, long, possibly medieval wall for this Colour Clough site that's brought us here today.
Pre-forestry, this landscape was a farmed landscape, granted not an intensively farmed landscape, at least not in the context of intensive farming today, but there's significant evidence that people were here, people were using the landscape, probably understanding the landscape in some ways more intimately than we do today. So yeah, there's a lot of evidence of that cultural use of this landscape that dates back to far before the forest was a thing.
I I'm Historic Environment Advisor, and I'm specifically tasked with managing all of the heritage and archaeology within the Woodland Creation Scheme,
wow.
but also within our wild areas, and that's where we are today, okay. in the Kilda Wild Area.
So you've seen the site on the ground a bit now, but what do you know about this site already? What work has already been done here?
So the site was identified as part of a bigger survey, which identified hundreds of similar sites. This one really piqued our interest, and mm-hmm. so we followed it up with a walkover survey, two types of geophysics, and then a topographic survey as well.
So by topographic survey, you mean somebody came out and measured all these lumps and bumps and structures and
indeed, yes.
Yeah. So do you feel you understand it now you're here?
A little bit better. As is always the case with archaeology, it usually going to visit a site as on the ground and raises more questions, and really that's what brings us all here today.
Absolutely.
To start to unpick some of those.
Yeah. So we'll need a bit of time to formulate some of those questions, but it is a site very definitely that is worthy of a bit of inquisition, let's put it that way, gentle
yeah.
inquisition.
I think so.
That laser bed's quite interesting, isn't it?
It's so good to be out on site and properly looking at the lumps and bumps and understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
Stuart, since we've come down off the hill and arrived here, what are your thoughts now? Have they changed?
Okay, well, the first conversations you use the word shealings. Shealing is a specific type of structure which relates to transhumans, where in the summer the farmers bring their sheep, their cattle up onto the high ground to graze, and then they can grow crops down in the valley bottoms. Mm-hmm. If you don't know this landscape and you don't know the complexity that can go with them, they can be led up some blind alley. Right. So that's why I was really excited to come and have a look, because the grouping here looks very different to a lot of other groupings I've seen.
Right, so and in that sense you mean perhaps doesn't look like a typical shealing site?
It's got elements of a shealing or a shealing, group of shealings. It's also got elements of what you look like longhouses, effectively long rectangular buildings with yards and little paddocks on the end of them. Those rectangular structures, the really interesting facet of those to me is their size. They're up to 30 metres long, which is way beyond you'd expect for a shealing,
right.
way beyond it. It's the organisation of this group, which is probably the most interesting bit. Is it a group of farms together? Is it a group of people living together? Is it a settlement? Is it occupied all year round? The unusualness of it opens up more questions than it actually allows you to answer just by looking at a plan.
Yes.
It's not just the structures, it's their relationship to other features on the ground we need to think about. And can you get any evidence about the environment, what might have been grown there, what the climate conditions were like? That will help understand the narrative here, because my suspicion is it's quite a long narrative here.
Yes.
It's not just one site, one period.
Mm-hmm.
It starts potentially off as some shealings. They're always close to water, where you can bring the animals and they need plenty of water. It's got plenty of sunlight facing southwest over mm-hmm. that direction. It's ideal for grazing. But over time, it evolves into something bigger, more formal, more organised. One of the background factors we cannot ignore here is the history of this region. It's border territory. It's been disputed territory since forever.
Yeah.
Until the Union of the Crowns in 1603, this is border reiver territory. Reiver means theft,
right.
thieves.
Yeah.
Raiding parties came from Scotland over here, and raiding parties went back. And it was all about theft of cattle. That was, you know, the major economic commodity. Protection of that resource, where you put your cattle, where you graze them, how you look after them, is all inherent and built into the philosophy of some of these structures and where they're placed and what form they have even. So you can't divorce that kind of historical context from the monument form that we see.
these types of sites have been really poorly investigated beyond a walkover survey and a quick, that's a shealing site or that's a deserted medieval settlement. So people have visited, they've recorded and then they've moved on. So an opportunity to undertake an excavation in a really remote area, and that's going to be a problem getting people to site and working out how we do it. But if we scale it and we're sensible with our targets, it has the potential to properly give us some meaningful information that we just don't have on similar sites.
I think so. I think one of the another concerns that I have slightly is that we know from excavations that have been done on sites like this in this part of the world, they're not rich in finds.
Okay.
So it's not going to be like digging a Roman villa and lots of shiny objects come out, you know, all sorts of decorations.
I'm fine with that.
Keeps the cost down.
Yeah, exactly.
A bit,
and as long as there's enough just to help us understand the date.
The dating is critical, but also the structure relationship, just get some handle on what might be going on get a start on this site.
I'm really pleased you like the site. I'm really pleased you find it genuinely interesting and exciting, because his little face today when we arrived was a big Cheshire grin smile.
I don't want to go home, Dad. I want to stay and play.
It's all right. I've made you a lovely little house. You can stay here.
Oh, nobody noticed the roundhouse, did they?
So what I'm hearing, Stuart, is that we need to come here and do some targeted excavations as part of a specific time team investigation.
I'd like to think so.
Excellent. Yeah. You've heard it here first.
Well, there you go. Stuart and Lawrence might want it to happen, but there's a lot more to consider after that initial recce before a site gets the go-ahead for further time team involvement.
Yeah, now places like this are really difficult, aren't they? And Northumberland is absolutely full of them. Places that you only find by trekking across the mountains for an entire day. And I suppose that's partly why they're so well preserved. Now, I've done my fair share of carrying survey equipment, digging equipment, packed lunch over the hills for an hour. And then after that, starting the hard physical labour for the day and then carrying everything back home again, including the soil samples. The problem with those is that they're right on the edge of what's possible. The people who are living there or using those buildings are going to be right on the breadline. And when you couple that with the fact that this is exactly the point of the little ice age when the climate is really, really horrible, it would have been pretty bleak.
Now, last year, we brought you our programmes from the tiny village of Norton Disney, the ancestral home of the Disney family, where Time Team went in search of a moated medieval manor house.
The whole community got involved, with dozens of test pits being dug in front and back gardens, helping to get us a picture of what was happening in the village at the time.
We've actually got a couple of banners from the site which marked each test pit. They've all been signed by loads of people in Time Team, and we're going to give them away. I think we're going to throw in a load of Time Team merchandise as well, a few little bits and bobs. If you visit Time Team's social media and our website as well for more details on that. But the whole project, of course, was masterminded by Time Team's Carenza Lewis, who is here with some exciting news to share about it. Hello, Carenza.
Hi there.
Hiya.
Let's talk about these test pits then, because there were so many of them. What was the idea behind having so many across such a wide area of the village?
Well, we had quite an active discussion about that in planning when I was saying, yep, sure, we can have 100 volunteers and dig 23, 24 test pits. And there was a certain strong sense of anxiety around the fact that we should have half as many as that. And I was told if it didn't work, it was on me. So I was immensely pleased it did work. But because we got 22 test pits dug in a small village, we've got a quite good sense of what goes on. And I always say it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, Norton Disney is a relatively small jigsaw puzzle because it's a relatively small village. So the fact that we've got 22 pieces of it is kind of, really good, because it gives us better definition. There's fewer gaps, as it were, and we can sort of see the pattern emerging as well.
But it's such a huge amount of information, isn't it? The data contained in those test pits is vast. How on earth did you handle it all? How did you work on it to bring out some answers?
I suppose the most important thing we look at is the pottery, because the pottery is so useful because it can be dated easily visually. And pottery tells us so much. It tells us where it was made. It tells us something about the standard of living, if you like. And then, of course, there's the animal bone. It tells us something about diet and, again, standards of living. And then we've got stuff like stone. Typically, stone includes worked flint, but Norton Disney had a very special sort of stone find that we really weren't expecting.
So what have you discovered, in short? What's your update on what happened at Norton Disney when?
I suppose, and Helen, you might be particularly interested in this as a sort of Anglo-Saxonist, the really unexpected thing, the gap that we had when we were digging there and when we were doing the Upsum live on the programme, was that we didn't have anything really before the late Anglo-Saxon period. We had virtually no Roman at all, and we had nothing predating the Torksey ware, really. What we discovered when the pottery report came back is we got one test bit 12, had four sherds of early Anglo-Saxon pottery, so sort of 5th to 9th century. And four sherds in a test pit for that sort of date is a lot, much, much more than we normally get. We only usually get that sort of material in about 2 test bits out of 100, 1 in 50. Wow. So the fact we had it in any is quite impressive.
It's so crumbly often, isn't it? It survives so badly, and there was so little of it produced to begin with. I mean, it's incredible that you managed to find that.
Yes, I mean, I've actually brought some of it in here. I don't suppose it'll show, but I mean, you can get an idea of sort of what it looks like. Again, I'm sure the focus isn't too good, but, you know, it just looks, I'm trying to put it, although you'll see a slightly darker, lighter background there. You know, it's quite a big sherd. And, you know, there's a couple of other bits. The really significant thing about this bit in particular is, yes, this is AFSO. And if you look blank about that, that's because this is an entirely new type of early Anglo-Saxon pottery.
Wow.
So Jane Young, who was reported on millions of sherds probably, has not seen this before. It's abundant organic tempered, basically.
Oh, so lots of grass or chaff or something incorporated into the fabric of the pot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can see well enough. You might need to take my word for it, but there's little sort of holes in it there on both sides, which is where the organic material is burned out during fire. And of course, the organic material, whether it's chaff or seeds or grass or whatever, is mixed in with the clay to stop it cracking during firing, because if you just have clay, it all expands at the same rate too quickly and then it'll crack. Whereas you've got stuff expanding at different rates, it stops it cracking. It's a bit like those strips that you have in the road to stop on bridges to stop it cracking. Yeah, to have an entirely new form of pottery is really exciting. And another reason that's exciting is we've now got this little node of Anglo-Saxon settlement or Anglo-Saxon period settlement, which is the earliest origin of settlement at Norton Disney and is probably where the people from the villa site, the Roman settlement site that produced that dodecahedron a couple of miles away, it's probably where they moved to. So it's pushing back the origins of Norton Disney as a known site from its first record in Domesday Book in 1086 by at least 500, well, about 500 years, half a millennium.
Wow. This is keeping you very busy, isn't it?
Well, thank you so much, Carenza. And a feature-length version of our Norton Disney film is coming to our YouTube channel on Saturday. As usual, it will be available ad-free for Time Team members on Patreon.
Let's dive now into some of the archaeology stories making headlines right around the world. And I'm going to start you off in a nature reserve. This is near Killin in the Central Highlands of Scotland. Archaeologists there have uncovered the site of secret illegal whiskey distilling. Now, illicit whiskey was popular in the 18th and 19th century after small household stills, these are things used in the whiskey making process, were banned. Well, archaeologists have found part of a still as well as stones and a timber post of the bothy where all the equipment was housed. It's thought that the site has been hidden now for more than 200 years. Really exciting stuff.
Yes, now these stills are remarkable because they need very precise requirements. They've got to have water, of course, to do the distillation process. They need a level site for the fire, and they also need vegetation or kind of curves in the landscape to hide them. And they're mainly built of turf, maybe with a little bit of stone, like the buildings at Kildare, in fact, and they're just a little bit later than that. Those small stills were banned in the Excise Act of 1788, and that seems to have been designed to discourage Scotland's whisky trade to England. The thing about these places is, if these stills were successful, we don't know about them. They only make their way into history if they're found and if they're shut down. So archaeology is essential. Even though those sites are only 200 or 300 years old, archaeology is the only way we can know about them. They're still really mysterious, because the thing I don't understand is, what about the smoke? I mean, didn't that give them away? How did they actually work in practice? We've excavated, I think, about 9 of these completely now, and I still don't understand them.
First I'm hearing of them, though. It's very, very interesting. Okay, this next one is, it's a really good one. If you are always putting things down and then you can't remember what you did with them, spare a thought for this poor medieval person who lost his notebook only for it to be discovered centuries later in the toilet. Excavations during conservation work in the city centre of Paderborn in Germany led to the discovery of buried remains. And whilst they were investigating those, they uncovered the rare small book dating to around the 13th or 14th century.
Our toilets, lavatories, latrines, they're absolutely wonderful things, aren't they? Because once you've dropped something into it, you are probably not going to be trying to get it out again. It makes some absolutely brilliant finds traps. And that writing tablet, it's made from wood and it's filled with beeswax. And it's exactly the kind of thing I was talking about last week with the stylus. So you would have used a metal or bone or antler stylus to make temporary notes on the wax. And then you would smooth it over again and use the wax over and over again. And on this one, you can see what look like smoothing marks on the wax. And then about half of one page has been used, one wax page has been used for making notes in Latin, which is interesting. To me, it all sounds very much like it fell out of a bag or a pocket. And I think we've all experienced when the phone falls out of your pocket into something awful.
Yeah.
Instead of having all your photos and texts on it, this tablet just had 7 lines of Latin. So maybe it wasn't the end of the world. Maybe the person, well, if they were educated enough to write in Latin, they were probably rich enough to buy another tablet to take notes on. But the great thing about this is that wood and wax, of course, they're organics, they decay really easily, and it's so well preserved because as a deep latrine, it was waterlogged at the bottom. I am really excited to see what is made of this. We're going to need some quite sophisticated imaging to find out exactly what the Latin says, but also to see if there are any, the stylus could have scratched through the wax and marked into the wood. So are there any traces of earlier notes? It could be literally like a kind of palimpsest where you get scratches of previous notes being made. So although it only seems to have 7 lines of Latin at the moment, there could be much, much more there that we'll be able to find out about in the future. So I think we need to keep an eye on that one.
I wonder what he was saying. What was he writing about? Okay, finally, I know we enjoy shipwrecks, don't we, on this podcast. So I thought I'd mention this story from Canada. The story actually starts in 1845 when 2 ships of the Franklin Expedition departed England with an aim of discovering a Northwest Passage, an Arctic route to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. However, the ships and their 129 crew members became stuck in ice off a Canadian archipelago in late 1846. The surviving 105 crew members then tried to walk to safety, you know, across the ice. All of them died on the way. Now new DNA research on the sailors' remains have discovered modern-day descendants, which I think is amazing. This new analysis, it sheds light on exactly where each ship's crew travelled in their doomed attempt, basically, to find safety. And we can also put names to some of the bodies.
Yes, it's fascinating stuff, this. It's just like the technique that was used to identify Richard III. What you do is you track down living members of the family, so direct descendants if they left any behind, but a lot of the time they didn't. I mean, certainly some of these people were really quite young and hadn't had any children. What they've used for this is great-great-great-nieces and nephews to compare the DNA. What we don't know yet is exactly where they've been found, and more importantly, maybe how they've been found and what kind of place it is, because I gather that one of them was found over 100 miles away from where the ships were abandoned. The Franklin expedition is such a sad story. Weirdly, we can all relate to these stories of their heroic failures, aren't they? They tried to do an enormous thing, tried to find the Northwest Passage and the solution to how to get to the fertile lands of the East and China and India with all the things that we wanted to export back to Britain without the Americas getting in the way. I mean, we now know that it was a pretty futile set of expeditions, but they didn't know that then. They set out with such great hope for it all to end in such horrible and harsh situations where they were desperately trying to get home and to come out alive and to tell the story, and they never did. It's such a sad story, but such a fascinating story, and every little bit of extra information about 1, 2, 3, 4 crew members, it's just so evocative, isn't it?
It really, really is. And as you say, a really, really sad story that didn't actually happen that long ago. I mean, 1846 isn't a million years ago, is it? So you can really, I think, still feel quite close to some of these people. That is the Time Team News for now. We are going to, of course, continue to keep you updated with very exciting and interesting archaeological stories as they happen here on the Time Team podcast.
One of the things our Time Team programmes became well known for was the graphic reconstructions of the buildings, landscapes and people that we uncovered.
Yeah, and now Time Team members can actually get access to those in more detail than ever before. Over on Patreon, you can get to explore the 3D models and worlds for yourself, as well as learn about how they were created.
Now, the whiz behind the beautifully made images is Bear, who's here to give you a taste of what he gets up to. Hello, Bear.
Hello.
My first question to you, Bear, has got to be, I mean, looking at some of these images, how long do these things take?
Depends on the reconstruction. Some of them are 5-6 weeks. Obviously, we wait the 9 months or so after a dig to get the science back in and collate all the information from all the different departments as best we can, and try and use every little scrap of evidence from the site to inform what we put in the model. So whether you see a particular bush or a blade of grass or a certain type of pot through to the floors, they're all informed by things we find in sight.
Is that things like drone footage and LIDAR? And I mean, what kind of data do you use?
Literally every department's information comes in slowly. So I'm often pestering different departments to say, can you explain geophysic results and getting the soil analysis samples for Naomi's flotation to tell me what seeds and plants are in? My favourite reconstruction has to be the Wynfarthing one, because we were able to tell what month of the year, what plants were in the ground, what plants were in the grave, the wood that she was laid on, the apples that were at her feet in a bowl. They were all informed by the science in the ground. And then with all the stains in the cloth, I think Helen, you taught me through different parts of the finds and the dig, original dig. So we were able to put all the little bits and pieces down the chatelaine and the dagger and all those little tiny little moments in there to kind of flesh out this moment of this poor woman's death.
With your reconstructions, they're so detailed, aren't they? There's none of that kind of smudging that you used to sometimes get in archaeological illustration. I mean, there was a very famous illustrator called Alan Sorrell who used to do these reconstructions where the weather was always absolutely terrible and the fires were almost smoking. So anything he didn't know about, he could cover up with a bank of fog or a puff of smoke or a terrible sheeting down rain. But you tend to have beautiful sunlight and fluttering butterflies, and it's they're so detailed. Is your style kind of a rod for your own back?
Absolutely. Half the stuff that I put in there you never even see, or I'll end up building an environment and never pointing the camera in that direction. That's my own fault, because I try and make these full-fledged world. And that comes more into play outside of the episode graphics when we make material for Patreon and virtual worlds and VR and other models. So you get to see a lot more and explore. Something we are looking at rolling out more of is the accessibility to the work we have done over the last few years. So we've got various things up and coming where we're re-looking at and extending reconstructions and letting people explore them a lot more.
This might seem like a bit of an obvious question, Bear, but I think it's one worth talking about, which is why is this attention to detail and this historical accuracy so important when doing these reconstructions?
Why is it important? I think because there is so much wonderful science and archaeological data that now comes in, we have to include it. Otherwise, we are missing part of the process. So we're trying to depict worlds. All the experts of Time Team are coming to me and saying, oh, we've got this ditch, it means this, and here's a comparison site, and this archaeological find means that this building has a different status than another one. And I just want to shoehorn as much as possible to try and make it as accurate as we can in the time frame we've got, and whilst fleshing out what could be quite difficult for people to visualize. So I'm always asking 500 million questions to the experts.
And I think, Martin, that it's important for us as the experts to be asked those questions, because if Bear isn't asking us, we can find it quite easy not to think about it. Something that's difficult, we might ignore. But if Bear, and I remember saying this about Victor years ago, Victor Ambrose, if somebody like Victor or Bear with that historical knowledge and attention to detail doesn't ask us about these things, then we can just fudge it, which isn't right. We're not dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's until an artist asks us.
Now, I know you're sitting there in front of your computer, Bear, so can we get a little sneaky peek at some of the graphics you're working on at the moment?
Well, we are putting together and putting out material that explores more of the Time Team sites in a virtual way for people to get really interactive with them. So we've been working on some virtual tours of recognizable reconstructions so people can explore them themselves and pop on a VR headset and have a look around and really get to grips with the inside of some of the locations.
So is this Broughton Villa? This looks incredible.
This is Broughton Villa, yeah. So I hop around, we've got the little shrine over here and people will recognise it from the version that was done for the graphics of the programme, but this is the new lightweight virtual headset version. So we're informing all the information. We have the cameo reconstruction and the Ungen bottle. And
Bear, what's on the floor? There seem to be some...
On the floor, at the moment, we have scattered petals. And then we have a speculative mosaic. Now, we didn't find a in situ mosaic, but we did find tesseract, didn't we?
Look at that. That is just incredible. The opulence that there must have been in that villa. You know, we see it as just leftover stone walls now, but of course it was vast and incredibly rich, and that really brings it to life.
That just looks so great. The work that you do and the attention to detail, Bear, it is honestly amazing. I know there's loads of stuff over for Time Team members over on Patreon where people can explore some of the worlds for themselves, some of the 3D models as well. What can people get on Patreon when it comes to the 3D graphics that you do?
So we put all the models, interactive finds, digital reconstructions and 3D drone scans of trenches and buildings. They're all on Patreon for the members to explore and look at and see some of the process. We are also putting out explorable versions of the reconstructions so people will be able to have a look around themselves and have a poke around in the Fugu or a villa or whatever we put up next. So we tie them into ongoing projects, but we've got plenty of things that haven't been released that we've been working on. So there's a lot to come and a lot more new projects, even more. So you've got digital artifacts to interact with, you've got reconstructions, reconstruction finds, and virtual tours include the virtual tours behind the scenes of the actual shoots, the film shoots themselves.
Great. So much to enjoy. Well, look, Bert, thank you so much for giving us a little peek behind the curtain, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it from the Time Team podcast.
I've got a little surprise, actually, a surprise guest in our episode next week for you, Helen. I think you'll find it quite fun.
Oh, I'll look forward to that then. Brilliant. Now, you can listen to that too, of course, plus all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts, or ad-free as a Time Team member on Patreon.
Until next time, take care, and we'll see you soon on the very next Time Team podcast.
Bye.